I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Since last fall, I've been to three of the 13 presidential libraries overseen by the National Archives. It's a goal to see all of them. It's become an obsession now, to the point where last month I flew to Los Angeles in the morning, went to the Richard Nixon Library, and flew home in the evening. It was a lot of fun, but the highlight was running into Brian Lamb. As someone who's interviewed people for nearly 10 years now, Brian Lamb's spare, unique, and engaging style of questioning has been an inspiration and an ongoing education. He's well known as an on-air presence on C-SPAN, the cable satellite public affairs network, which he founded in 1979. He's been its executive chairman for a couple of years now after stepping down as its CEO. He is the longtime host of their flagship interview program, Book Notes, which ran for 15 years, and which was succeeded by Q&A, which he's hosted for 10 years now. There's a new book highlighting the interview, Sundays at 8, 25 years of stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. The book is published by Public Affairs. The websites for more are at cspan.org and qna.org and booknotes.org. He has interviewed every president since Lyndon Johnson, as well as international figures such as Margaret Thatcher and Mikhail Gorbachev. Among many honors, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2007. The historian Douglas Brinkley dedicated his recent book of Walter Cronkite to David Halberstam and Brian Lamb, saying that Mr. Lamb is, quote, the most trusted man in American journalism today, and that he's the keeper of the archive of America, and that he is. As a Canadian, I spend far too much time on the C-SPAN website, indulging my interest in American history. Callers to the network often tell Brian, thank you for C-SPAN. I'm glad I get to say that as I welcome him to the Plant on the Line program from Washington, D.C. Today, Brian Lamb. Good morning, Mr. Lamb.
Thank you, Joseph, for being interested. It was really fun to meet you at the Nixon Library, and that's the last thing you expect is a Canadian that's semi-obsessed with American presidents and their libraries.
But I guess I wouldn't be the only one, I suppose. I mean, that's the gift of C-SPAN, that you're able to bring this sort of programming, this sort of education, this sort of information to people across your country.
Well, it is, you know, we've kind of taken it for granted the last few years because there's so much available on American television now, especially on the internet. But when we started, people my age and older, when we started, I was in my mid-30s. I am no longer in my mid-30s. were very excited because a lot of them had never seen the kind of things we were able to show. Now, people, the younger people take it for granted because there's so much available to them.
Do you find that in terms of the programming that you do in C-SPAN, not just the covering of the House, the Senate, and committees and the sort. I mean, I know you don't have ratings, but do you get a sense that people are watching the program, say, on the presidents, the first ladies, on American history that appear on the three channels?
The series programs we've done that you're alluding to, including the series we did on presidents back in the late 90s, a series we did on Alexis de Tocqueville, a series we've done on the first ladies, on the presidential libraries, we do get a sense that people are watching because people love series, and the historians in this country, and I'm talking about amateur historians, love when we begin to show things that they didn't know anything about or they knew very little about. We do take surveys every 4 years or so after the election to see if anybody's watching. We do not have ratings, and we have no idea on a day-to-day basis whether they're watching or not, but it usually turns out to be about the same. There's not a huge audience for what we do. I would say about 10% of the country, and we have 318 million people down here, about 10% of the country is involved in the network on a daily, couple of daily basis. They check in and look at things, and then there's another 30% that gets there on the big occasions, and then some 60% that never come to us.
Well, what about the, because we're seeing this now, we're seeing this in Canada, the White House is doing this, where they're broadcasting their own events, say, online on YouTube. They're doing sort of the job that C-SPAN used to do, or continues to do. Is that one of the challenges for the network?
So far, I can't tell. You know, the challenges for this network are, do we continue to convince the people that fund us that it's worth doing? The same thing is true in Canada. I mean, Canada's done a terrific job of a country that's, you know, almost one-tenth the size of the United States. They've built a terrific CPAC channel, and we worked with them very closely. Canada was ahead of the United States in televising the House of Commons years ago, and they were the model for the Americans when they put television in the House of Representatives. So we both have this problem because the government is definitely, for their own reasons, not undermining C-SPAN so much, but undermining the process of a private organization bringing this public affairs to the public at large. It's just the way it is. It's the way it happens. It's affordable, and this is happening throughout the United States government in all the different branches.
Bubby, you do think that 35 years from now there'll still be a C-SPAN?
I actually don't know. I'm hoping, but I must say that the economic model is changing here ever so slowly, and it really depends on how long this model stays together, and if it doesn't stay together, where we find the underwriting for what we do, and that's at the moment a kind of an unknown.
How do you think C-SPAN has done in terms of contributing to the political discourse in America? Do you think it's made people more informed? At the same time, I would think that it would perhaps make people apathetic, that they wouldn't have to worry about paying attention to government because C-SPAN is there, they're recording it. If something happens, say, in the House, the Senate, or at a committee, the news people pick it up and raise an alarm that way.
Joseph, I have to say I don't know for sure, because we've stayed away from studying the impact that we've had. But all of what you said is probably true, including the fact that there are people who have seen this process up close now and have become more cynical because of the way it looks to them when they can actually hear the conversation back and forth. Then there are others who it lit a match under, like me. When I was first with this network, I wasn't as big a book reader as I am now, and I found that by being here and getting involved and reading some interesting books and then doing a program on it. And you never quite know who's coming along for the ride. You don't know whether it's somebody that's already a reader and already involved or somebody who's been introduced to this by just happening to tune into the network. So I think every bit of what you would expect to happen with this network has, but whether it's had a big impact or not, I frankly doubt if I'll ever know.
And is the goal for you still to broadcast the proceedings at the Supreme Court?
It's a goal. It's not going to be reached soon. If it's my understanding that they do televise the Supreme Court in Canada.
Yeah, we do, yeah.
And they now do it in Great Britain, and they do it in most of the states of the United States. But our Supreme Court is being stubborn, and they think that it will have some negative impact on the court, and so they've been against it, and there's no indication whatsoever that they're going to change their mind at this moment.
Now, this book, Sundays at 8, it's such a great book because it gives a great overview of who's been on Q&A and book notes. How did you pick the people that are in this book? Because, first of all, they're not transcripts. But it's essentially their words as spoken on your programs. And not all of them are well known.
Well, these are not the best 25 interviews, not 41 interviews that I've done on this show. These are stories, more than often than not, that are compelling, and they kind of show the breadth of what we've tried to do over the last 25 years on this one-hour interview show on Sunday nights. This is our fifth book like this from that program. And we wanted to make sure that we didn't redo any of the chapters that we had done in the previous books. So that eliminated a lot of things that we could have put in the book that we liked, that I liked since we started this whole process. But the other interesting thing about it is when we started putting the book together, we had twice as much material when we finished it, and the publisher said, we can't do all that. We're going to have to cut it in half. So we cut it in half, and we might publish another book in a year or two that will be all biography, but we're not, we haven't gotten there yet. This is just supposed to be, if you pick this book up, every chapter should teach you something about the process of politics, American political culture, world events that have happened, and you can take your pick on what you like and don't like.
Yeah, there's a lot of it in the book that's also quite timely. It's almost current affairs, and I guess there'd be some of the recent interviews as well. When you look back at the 25 years of book notes and Q&A, but by the way, when you do the hour program, is that done, say, live to tape, or do you do,
yes,
like 2 hours? Oh, so you don't do two hours and cut it down, right?
My goal from the beginning was that everything goes on the air, so that if somebody walks in and you spend a lot of time talking to them, that they don't have to worry when they leave the studio that something's going to be cut out or changed and all that. Now, that was my goal. We do a lot of interviewing. It's not always me that does it for some of the documentaries we've done, and they know that that's not all going to be seen. However, we put part of it in the documentary, and then we put the rest of it on the web so that people can see the whole thing. Our objective is that everybody gets to see everything that we see.
And when you do the hour program, whether it's book notes or Q&A, is there a certain time of day that you do it?
No. It varies. We have a morning show that lasts here, live morning show from 7 to 10 East Coast time. So we don't do anything before 10:30. And then usually our window for recording that hour show is between 10:30 in the morning and about 3:30 in the afternoon.
And then you do, say, could you do two or three in a day?
Yes. Yeah. I'm doing one tomorrow, and I'm doing one on Friday. There have been days, especially when we travel, sometimes we go up to New York, and I might do as many as three in a day. It's not my favorite thing to do because I like to study what I've been learning before I sit down with somebody. And when you're going back-to-back, you don't have the same opportunity that you do if it's on different days.
And one of the things that you were well known for during the book notes here, so the 15 years that you did that, was that you spent something like 20 hours preparing for each hour of broadcast. For Q&A, I'm assuming that you spend as much time or just a little less?
It varies, but I try to spend a lot of time with it, fussing over, if it's a book, reading as much of the book as I can get to. If it's not a book, doing as much background research, again, as I can get to, because the more I know about the individual, the easier it is to ask questions that you think the audience would like to know about, and it also gives you an idea of what they've talked about before if you're looking to find things that they might not have talked about and walk into that territory, which is always very interesting.
Now, I'm assuming that most of the people that you've talked to have enjoyed the experience. Were there people that didn't like the hour that they spent with you?
I've never known of anybody that didn't like the hour. I have known of people that didn't like a question or two.
Hmm.
And that doesn't come back to you quickly, because people don't stomp out and they don't say nasty things when they leave the program. But you hear back usually from either their agent or you hear back. I mean, once in a while you'll have somebody, we had one author call one time and said, could you take out that particular area? And we never do. And it's usually self-serving. The reason they want us to take it out, they don't like it. But I've never had anybody say they just didn't flat like the interview, but you never really know what people think because, you know, they may come back again. And you know, I have to say I do the same thing, and when I'm out being interviewed, I would rarely ever complain to somebody about that because, you know, you're big people. You can sit down and usually take any question you're going to get unless somebody's just pure nasty to you, and we never are nasty to anybody.
Have there been people that have been nasty on the air, whether it's on your program or, say, on the call-in shows, that have gotten sued by someone else?
My recollection is we've been sued or threatened about being sued,
mm-hmm,
by people that have appeared on our call-in show. we certainly have never lost a suit. I mean, we haven't had that many. It doesn't happen very often. I'm sure that there have been some very controversial ones over the years where people are upset, but it doesn't happen very often. I mean, we're not, we don't have the gotcha journalism, and we have time, and we don't mess with it, so people kind of know when they walk out exactly what it's going to be like.
And I guess one of the things that, that C-SPAN is known for are sort of the prank callers that, that get on the air. Those annoy you, don't they?
Not always.
No.
And what I mean by that is if somebody calls up and does a prank call, you say, okay, I get it. It's when there begins to be a series of these calls, which are almost always men, young men, and they sound like they're in their 20s or 30s at most. Most of them live on the East Coast of the United States. And it comes in flashes because we don't have a delay, because we like things to be as spontaneous as possible so people don't fear that we're going to cut them out, cut them off, or take something away. And there are exasperating times where it doesn't stop for several days, and that's the only time that I find it to be that irritating.
What makes for a good interviewer? I mean, and in terms of how you feel, does that factor at all? I mean, if you, after an interview with someone and you say, well, I got a good story out of them, or the guest appeared to enjoy it, or that we covered a lot of material, say, in a given time period. Do those things for you, do they mean a good interview?
Well, a good interview is a couple of things. One, if you're an interviewer, I think it's very important that you listen closely and act like you're listening closely and paying attention to what the guest is saying, because I've been a guest enough times to know that if you get the impression that somebody's not paying any attention, it's hard to talk about what you're interested in. If you're worried about having a good interview, you want them to be spontaneous. You don't want them to sound canned. One of the worst things you can do is talk to somebody when they're on their 15th interview stop of a book tour, because they're pretty much tired of talking about their book by then. They've said it all. And so you're better off if you get them early. I remember years ago, Mrs. Graham, who was the owner, chief executive officer of the Washington Post, mm-hmm. had a book that was quite good, quite interesting. And I got her second, and I remember saying to myself, thank goodness. I mean, she was older at the time. I don't know how old. She's probably younger than I am now. I'm 72, and she might have been in her late 60s. But I remember saying, I'm glad I got her now instead of, she was going on a nationwide tour, instead of when the tour was over, because she would really be tired of talking about it. I remember that distinctly. And I have seen people that I'm the last stop on a book tour. I think it was P.J. O'Rourke one time came in, and he'd been to, I don't know, golly, who knows, 30 places or something, and he just had a long overnight flight, and I said, I'll bet you're really sick of talking about this, and he said, you bet, I'm done. So, you know, that depends a lot. I mean, what your interview is depends on when you get them.
And do you find that you come away from some interviews regretting that you didn't ask a certain question, I mean, or wanting a do-over, say?
Never want a do-over, but I do come away from time to time listening to people tell me the most valuable thing they've told me after the cameras are down, and as they're walking out, and you just say, oh, my God, this would have been perfect. This is an important story to tell. And it's happened a lot over the years because people often say things after the interview's done that they don't want on camera. And if you hadn't thought about asking about it, then it makes it even feel worse.
A question that I get a lot, because I've done over 1,000 of these now in nearly 10 years in the fall, is what percentage of questions do I ask that I already know the answer to? And I'm wondering for you, what would that be?
Oh, it's probably north of 80%.
Yeah.
At least. I mean, if I've done my research, as you well know, as an interviewer, you're always trying to elicit new information that no one's gotten. I mean, that's the competitive juices flowing. But it's really hard to do, especially if somebody's been interviewed a lot. And I prepare a lot, so when I'm always amazed at the new stuff you can learn. I remember Willard Scott, who used to be on the NBC Today Show every morning.
The weatherman.
Right in the middle of one of my interviews, well, the only time I interviewed him, he decided that he wanted to tell the audience that he was an alcoholic. That was not ever told before. It was the first time he did it. And I asked him, why do you want to do this now? And he said, I just want the public to know that I'm an alcoholic and I'm recovering and I'm doing fine. And that's part of an alcoholic's effort by admitting they are to get well, and those are things you don't plan on and you don't know until you get them, but they're always interesting.
We've talked about your preparation already, and I find that sometimes when I do these, that if I prepare too much, it can be overwhelming. Yeah.
I do. And I also don't have any great expectations, as a matter of fact. I go into an interview, I've got 3 hours worth of material, and I start from the beginning and think about the audience then, not about me. Because the audience usually doesn't know most of what you know. And so you have to start at the beginning, or you're going to have an audience that says, this doesn't sound interesting to me, I don't know what they're talking about.
And then you used to get the criticism, too, that some of your simpler questions underestimated the intelligence of the audience.
Still do.
Yeah.
But I don't underestimate the intelligence of the audience. I underestimate the lack of knowledge of the audience because they may not have paid much attention to this particular area. And that has nothing to do with their intelligence, and it has nothing to do with their upbringing, their education. As I find so often that I'm into an area I have no knowledge about whatsoever, and I've been around for a long time, read a lot of books, but I think you find out as you get older and do more and more of this how much you don't know.
Yeah, I find that. I mean, after 10 years, I mean, there's still stuff that I, you know, about interviewing, especially, you know, when I talk to interviews like yourself, that I'm learning all the time. See, if I watch Q&A on the weekend, there'll always be something that I'll pick up. And
I hope.
Who did you learn from? Were there people, like interviewers, that you grew to emulate, sir?
No, I never grew to emulate anyone. I didn't want to be like anybody. Oh, when you're a kid, you do. I mean, that's what you do. You start off imitating everybody. I remember when I was young, I found myself having the same pattern as former NBC anchorman David Brinkley, and I got out of that fast. I had a high school teacher that taught me the basics of interviewing, and it's very simple, but it's hard, especially when you, in this day and age, when people are paid extraordinary amounts of money to interview. I mean, Matt Lauer on the Today Show makes $25 million a year, and he has to do, he's not a particularly flashy personality, but he has to do something that's keeping that audience there. It becomes very important. And you just have to keep in mind all the time that it's you do it your way, not what somebody else is doing. But I've watched and listened to every interviewer over the years that I could find and tried to pick up little things from them. I tell you, most of the interviews in commercial television today, though, drive me crazy because they put words in the person's mouth rather than just asking them the question. So I don't emulate them. I mean, I know why they do it. They don't have much time. They also are highly paid and they have to perform, but I would much rather they stay out of it.
Are there particular interviewers that you like?
I don't really, and there's nobody I really like or nobody I dislike as much as there are some that I watch more than others, and You know, I really don't have a list of them, and it every day is different. It depends on, I'm going through my mind right now trying to think of, I find that some of the radio interviewers are the best, but that's turned into a personality-centric deal every day, too, because you have to make a big name and you have to say strong things or people won't tune in, and they tune in for the personality. So there's not much of it being done around anymore. I mean, there's some very good interviewers. Actually, you know, who's a guy that I've always enjoyed, and I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember his name. You're going to tell me immediately. It's the guy that does the nightly news in Canada. I've interviewed him several times. Is it Mansbridge?
Yeah, Peter Mansbridge, yeah.
Peter Mansbridge, who I find his style to be, and I don't see him that often, but I find his style to be very attractive, and I've always thought he had a very nice presence.
Did you think over the years that your interview style has changed?
Not much. I've gotten better at listening. I've tried to shorten my questions, although I find myself from time to time talking too much. It drives me crazy. I've tried to get, I mean, my questions often are poorly, they're poor syntax. And I've tried to simplify it because it doesn't work when you're hemming and hawing around. It looks terrible on paper. It doesn't sound as bad when you're listening to it. But I've read the transcripts of my interviews over the years, and there are often times when I cringe.
In the book, you have... I guess, was it the last interview that Christopher Hitchens did?
I don't know for sure. I think it was the last television interview he did. He talked to people up to till he lost his voice. But it certainly was, if it wasn't the last, it was one of the very last.
Yeah, and he appeared on C-SPAN a number of times over the years with you. Did he like you?
We got along very well all the time. Christopher didn't, I think he avoided being your buddy. I never sensed that we were pals or buddies or anything like that, and didn't want to be. I never socialized with him, and he socialized with a lot of people around. He was a phenomenon. There were not many humans that I've met or interviewed like him, and there's nothing to do with me thinking everything he ever said was something I'd agree with. As a matter of fact, he could be terribly cruel to people from time to time. He just was always an interesting interview. You never knew what he knew until you asked him about it, and he knew a lot.
Now, someone who isn't in the book, but who I've seen a lot of over the years on C-SPAN, on the website at least, William F. Buckley Jr., was he someone you enjoyed talking to?
He was kind of a hard interview because of his speech pattern. He was a slow talker, and you had to be ready for it, and you couldn't be in a hurry. But he was a happening. I mean, he was... I didn't interview him that much. But he was incredibly popular both on the right and the left because of... The left thought he was erudite and bright and all that, and so they gave him the benefit of the doubt, and he was one of the few conservatives on our American public television, and he had his own show there, Firing Line, for years. Mm-hmm. But if you had to ask me, would I want to interview Bill Buckley a lot? No. I always enjoyed seeing him, and I didn't know him very well, but he was a very big personality in this country. I'm much better with somebody that reacts quickly to a question and begins to teach the audience what they know, and that's when I'm the happiest.
Now, we mentioned that we ran into each other at the Nixon Library about a month ago. As a student of history that you are, is there a president that you find more fascinating than all the others?
Well, I had the experience of working around Lyndon Johnson, physically being around him for 2 years when I was in the Navy. And he was bigger than life, both with his incredible political savvy and his crudeness. I mean, he was really an unusual character. It's not a sense of admiring him so much as he's very complicated. Robert Carroll has done over 3,000 pages on his history, and I find that all worthwhile and interesting. And our network has run thousands of hours of Oval Office conversations that were recorded by Lyndon Johnson when he was president, and it's just a package of great learning. I'm surprised, because I never, even though I'm from the state of Indiana, where Abraham Lincoln lived for 14 years, I didn't know much about him. I hadn't paid that much attention. My schooling in Indiana did not include much about him, believe it or not. I was surprised at how fascinating he was once I got into it. And we've done an enormous amount of Lincoln. But I don't have a favorite president. I have presidents that certain aspects of them I find terribly interesting, but I don't walk around with a favorite, and I tend to look at them as an amateur historian, being interested in how they differed from one another.
But there are some boring ones, aren't there? Like Millard Fillmore doesn't strike me as particularly interesting.
No, but every president has something that is unique about them. Millard Fillmore, when I went to his home outside of Buffalo, New York, I was kind of surprised about this little tiny cottage. Didn't amount to much. And, you know, you remember those kind of things. You remember how simple their life must have been. And we're just going through in the United States the rollout of Hillary Clinton's book and the interviews that she's having. And she just had Diane Sawyer in her home. And you see this gorgeous home that they have up in Chappaqua, New York. And you compare that with how a lot of the early presidents live. And you just see how far we've come since those days.
Will Hillary Clinton be on Q&A?
She has turned us down.
I see. Did you get a lot of people turning you down?
It's been harder lately, believe it or not, than early. And the primary reason for that is they don't want to sit for an hour. They also have a lot of outlets that they can go to that they know the audience, the size of the audience. We don't know the size of any audience. And we don't have personalities. And so they only want to do so many interviews. I was disappointed that Bob Gates would only do 30 minutes with us here, and so that meant that we couldn't do an hour program with him on Q&A. But it's a much different world than when we started. CNN hadn't even been created in our early days. And so now you've got CNN and MSNBC and CNBC and Fox News and Fox Business and Bloomberg, and you go down the list of all the programs that have interviews on it. It's just getting harder and harder.
How long do you think you'll continue with Q&A?
We joke around here because Susan Swain, who is a co-chief executive officer since I stepped down, we joke about her having a little red card that she'll hand me one day, which basically says it's over. I will tell you that I will take myself off the air before anybody will take me off, unless something happens to the network I don't know about. The day that I feel that I'm not with it and that I'm not as sharp as I used to be remembering things is the day that I'll say it's time to quit, and I won't have a hard time doing that.
But it's still a lot of fun, and you're still learning lots, right?
That's what keeps me going. Right. It is a... You know, I come to work every day. I get here very early in the morning. I usually leave all about this time in the afternoon, a little bit later. And I have this, you know, program I'm preparing for tomorrow, one on Friday. It's very stimulating to me. I'm still learning lots of other things that I do around here to stay busy, but I'm not engaged in the day-to-day decisions anymore. But the learning, and you said it earlier, learning is the number one thing that really is a kick. I still get a rush out of learning things that I didn't know.
Brian, it was such an unexpected pleasure to meet you in Yorba Linda last month, and it's such an honor to have you on today because, as you know, I've, you know, stolen from you a lot over the years and still learn a great deal when I watch your programs. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Well, Joseph, thank you for being interested. I have to tell you that is the kick of the day or the week or the year when somebody comes up to you and says, I've been watching, I remember this interview. I think anybody in our business lives for that more than anything else. So it's a real pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you at another American Presidential Library someday.
Yeah, I've got 10 to go, so. And I guess Washington is a good place to go. Well, D.C. is a good place to go because there's no presidential libraries there, but, I mean, there are museums all over in the sort, right?
Well, here in D.C., you have everything from William Howard Taft's grave, a former president from Ohio, to John F. Kennedy's whole family is buried on the hillside at Arlington National Cemetery. You have the cottage where Abraham Lincoln used to go during the summers to get cool, which is not more than 3 miles from the White House. You've got the home that Woodrow Wilson, the former president, lived in over here on S Street, I believe it is, in the District of Columbia. He's buried at the National Cathedral. You can just keep going down the list. George Washington's home out at Mount Vernon. There's more here to keep you busy than you can imagine.
Yeah. Well, thanks for this, Brian. I really appreciate it again. Thank you.
Great, Joseph. Thank you.
The website's cspan.org. That's c-span.org, booknotes.org, and q&a.org. q-and-a.org. Book is called Sundays at 8, 25 Years of Stories from C-SPAN's Q&A and Book Notes. It's published by Public Affairs. Brian Lamb joined me on the line from Washington, D.C. and Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.